Today on Maine Calling, methamphetamine use on the rise. When it comes to combating substance use and addiction, there is some good news in Maine. More people are getting the help they need. Opioid overdoses have been down for the past couple of years. But addiction specialists and police officers are also reporting a disturbing new trend. More people addicted to methamphetamine, or meth, which is highly addictive and difficult to treat. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn more about the meth on the streets right now. Experts say it is far more dangerous than what used to be available, and its impact on users can be devastating. We'll also hear from people in recovery about what helped them. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Although Maine is doing better on some fronts, when it comes to substance use, new challenges have emerged. Methamphetamine use is on the rise. Today we're going to learn what's happening, what's being done, and how some people in recovery have found a path forward. Joining me, Leslie Clark, who is Executive Director of Portland Recovery Community Center, Matt Emke, who refers to himself as a grateful recovering addict and alcoholic. He is a peer leader in the recovery community and the firm administrator for Integrated Tax Consultants. And Gordon Smith, Director of Opioid Response with the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation and the Future. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about methamphetamine or other drugs and their effects? Do you know someone who is in recovery or someone who needs help? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'll repeat that number, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for being here today. And Gordon, I'll start with you. Your title is Director of Opioid Response for so many years. The devastating problem that we heard about was the devastating rise in opioid use. But now we're talking about methamphetamine. Tell me what the difference is. They're completely different kinds of drugs, and what you're seeing in just this past year.
Well, Jennifer, it's a pleasure to be back on. Governor and I have been at this now for 6.5 years, and we're beginning, you know, we've really seen quite an improvement in our overdose fatalities over the past about 2.5 years, really down about 40% from the high point. So we're very close to getting back to where we were before the pandemic. So that's a positive thing. There are more people
40%,
alive.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And just this year, we're down a continuing decline of 25% just as of yesterday. So that's a very positive thing. Now, at the same time, we still lose people every week, and it's still too many deaths. In terms of the substances used, we have seen a decline in fentanyl, and we've seen an increase in stimulants. But it's not been as dramatic as the recent series in the New York Times would seem to suggest that was printed and featured Portland. We've seen decline in overdoses in Portland as well as around the state, as I've said. But we have the increase in stimulants, including meth and cocaine, have been fairly modest. And they appeared, these drugs, meth specifically, was in 33% of the overdoses in 2023 and 37% of the overdoses last year. But almost every overdose is at least three substances involved. And oddly enough, although it's a shame to see this increase in stimulants, it is actually ironically probably helping to keep some people alive, because the more stimulant that's there or other adulterants, the less fentanyl there is. And it really was the fentanyl that was really killing people.
You know, we heard a lot during the debate about whether or not to legalize marijuana that this marijuana wasn't your parents' marijuana. It's different than it used to be. That's the same case with this methamphetamine, right? This methamphetamine is a different kind of methamphetamine that we heard about a lot, say, in the 90s.
Oh, it's completely different. And I'm going to leave to Dr. Sylvia, who's going to be calling in, one of our addictionologist, and she's treating a lot of people for meth, and she'd be far more knowledgeable in how what she sees now is different than she might have seen 5 years ago even.
But it's coming from a different place even, right?
Well, this is all about synthetics, and it's the same with fentanyl as well, is that these are all chemicals, and they can be made at home, or they can be made in Mexico, or they can be made in the Dominican Republic. So, you know, because they're all illegal drugs, we don't regulate the market, obviously. What's in the drug is anybody's guess. And that's why drug checking is now become more popular across the country, and why we're stepping, putting our toe in the water on people's ability to check their drugs before they use.
What does that mean, drug checking? How does that work?
It's different than drug testing. It's basically taking a very small residue of the drug and putting it through machines that can tell you what's in that sample. Is fentanyl in it? Is meth in it? Is cocaine in it? Is it heroin? And they're not rudimentary, but they won't tell you how much of a substance is in there. But if you really want, If a person that's addicted to substances and it really is trying to use only stimulants, for instance, and does not want fentanyl, then now there are places in Maine where you can go, and this has just started within the past few months, and have your sample tested to know whether it's got fentanyl in it or not. And we have also thousands of fentanyl test strips and xylazine test strips, which is also a form of drug checking.
All right. Well, that's so interesting, Gordon. I do want to circle back to the drug testing. I want to turn to you, though, Leslie, and just ask you what you're seeing on the recovery side. What has changed in the last year or so in terms of who's coming to you and what they're facing?
Thank you, Jennifer. It's so good to be here and get to talk about all of this morning. And the hope side of it as well. I think, you know, Gordon referenced the New York Times piece, and certainly this is a really devastating drug, and we see its impact on people in a different way than, and more recently in particular over the last few years. But there's also the hope side, and I know Matt's going to talk with us some about the recovery. But, you know, what we see at the Portland Recovery Community Center is, we just did a recent survey, and about 30% of our participants listed methamphetamine as primary or secondary, top one or two drugs that they are impacted by or that they were using or are struggling with getting into recovery from. And there has been a big change. They used to talk about with overdoses the triple wave phenomena, which started with prescription opioids in 99 up until like 2010. And then we started seeing the heroin overdoses. And then the third wave as fentanyl really came into the drug supplies in like 2014 and so many overdose deaths and so much attention and needed resources began to come into place. But now some people are calling this the fourth wave, where opioids and stimulants, the stimulants death are like three times higher than they were in 2018. So what we've seen is at the Recovery Community Center, and the way that directly people are impacted that's different is, you know, with opioids or with alcohol, people, while they were using While there might be some disruptive behavior, there wasn't the kind of mental health, like serious paranoia and hallucinations, and hard for us to sometimes know, is somebody having a mental health crisis or are they using crystal meth? And how do we intervene and how do we help them? And frankly, until, while people are in that early stage, there's not a lot that we can do at the Recovery Community Center to help people begin to connect and get well. They really need that medical intervention. They need some, immediate help crisis to be able to support them and get them the help that they need so that then, we can begin to talk about how to improve quality of life, how to move forward, and that there is hope. And there's a lot of hope for people.
Well, speaking of hope, Matt's here. And Matt, you have quite a story to tell about what you've experienced over the years. Tell us what led you to substance use and how you beat it.
It's a good question, right? What got me there and what got me better? So I had no reason to become an addict, which is, a lot of times people think, oh, if you're an addict, you had some adverse childhood experience, you had some abuse, you had a, a broken home. I didn't have any of that. I had very loving, supportive parents. They've been married 56 years. I have two older sisters who are married. My dad was a physician. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, which is a full-time job, especially with a kid like me. But yeah, I went to a really good school, and I was, did really well in academics. But I started with substances early. I had had my first beer probably in fifth grade. And then in high school, I joined a rock band, and it was a lot of weed, a lot of psychedelics. And I just seemed to be wired a little differently than my peers. We would have like a party in high school, and I was the last one up. I was finishing all the empties. I didn't understand people who would leave alcohol in a cup. So I just had a different experience with that. I also had a chronic pain condition when I was diagnosed when I was 14, which led me to a life of painkillers. And I had another diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder, which was treated with benzodiazepines. That's when I was, still in high school. So by the time I got to college, I was already, on a pretty long list of pharmaceuticals. And I didn't understand why. I thought, well, I can't be an addict because these are all prescribed by a doctor. And, the son and nephew of doctors, like, I couldn't imagine. I'm like, they would never do something that, was in my worst interest. And I don't think they did intentionally. I just don't think they knew that I was picking them up from the pharmacy, but I was taking them as I prescribed, not how they prescribed. Things really started to unravel, I guess, in my early 20s. I just lost jobs, car wrecks, all kinds of things. It was just a really kind of dark place. And cocaine, I think, was one of my drugs of choice, really. And by the time I was, I think, 28 maybe, I found myself in rehab for the first time through a family intervention. And I stayed sober for 2 years. And then once I relapsed, I just seemed to keep relapsing. I could maybe pull it together for about 6 months. And then I started using, and then within 3 months of starting using, I was always back in rehab. I think it was four or five 4th of Julys in a row. I remember being in a treatment center. And it wasn't because I didn't want to get sober. I really, really did want to get sober. It was, I just didn't understand how would I function, move through life without the substance, because the substance was, in my mind, it was the solution for everything.
Matt, I've read that it often takes many times, many tries at rehab, and that if people expect themselves to be cured after the first time, that's really, maybe expecting too much from oneself. This cycle you're talking about, was there something in the end that made the change?
I could point to maybe a couple things. I think the biggest difference was that in 2017, and this is following an overdose and being in a coma for a few days. I stayed sober about 6 months, and then I just couldn't stand being sober anymore, and I couldn't afford a cocaine habit because I was in sober living. It was very expensive. So I found meth. Meth is a lot cheaper. It lasts a lot longer. And that was really, that was the thing that and once I used it for the first time, I used it every day until 8 months later when I went into detox on June 22nd of 2018. So I'm grateful. I, say I'm a grateful recovering addict, alcoholic, because I'm grateful to meth because of 20 some years of using drugs and alcohol. That was the one thing that brought me to my knees, that brought me that gift of desperation where life was so bad. And I had lost so much so quickly that I was willing to do anything at that point. And I think that willingness was a thing that ultimately got me sober.
7 years now. Am I doing my math correctly?
It'll be 7 years on June 23rd. I think
Fantastic.
it's bad luck to round up. So
Okay.
in my mind.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for sharing your story. I'm sure there are people out there who are finding some serious solace in it and some hope. On the line with us now is Dr. Kristen Sylvia, who is, as Gordon Smith referred to, an addiction medicine specialist and family medicine provider at Maine Health, also an associate professor with the Tufts School of Medicine. Thank you so much for calling in, Dr. Sylvia.
Thank you for inviting me, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
And I'm wondering, are you seeing more methamphetamine addiction among your patients recently?
Most definitely, we have been, I would say, over the last couple of years. Most of the patients that we see in our practice do have opioid use disorder, but I would say more often than not, people use multiple substances, so that polysubstance use is the rule, not the exception anymore. And so we see more cocaine, certainly as a stimulant, and non-prescribed use of prescription stimulants, but we are seeing quite a lot of methamphetamine, unfortunately.
I'm sure you heard Matt say that methamphetamine, after everything else, gave him the gift, he said, of desperation, but put him in this really dark place. And I'm wondering, what effect, if you can describe from a medical point of view, what effect meth has on the body and on the brain?
Sure, methamphetamine, in my estimation and many others, is really one of, if not the most addictive substance that we see people use. There really is nothing else that will get your dopamine levels, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain, as high as methamphetamine would. So we use relative numbers and say, like, on a really good day for you or I, we might get our dopamine levels to 50. Methamphetamine will raise your levels up to 1,000. And so when there's a substance that will make you have such a dramatic response or have a dramatic response like that in your brain, it's very difficult for people to stop using it once they have used it for a period of time. So what methamphetamine does is it increases the levels of dopamine as well as serotonin and another chemical called norepinephrine. And it, as you'd imagine, it stimulates the brain, stimulates the body, so that can result in what people would describe as euphoria. They also can get quite agitated if they've taken it enough of it. People will describe having increased energy, focus, mental clarity. On the medical side, we'll see increased heart rate and pulse. Their pupils might be dilated. People will be sweaty. And then as that use progresses or as the doses get higher, you can have cognitive impairment, psychosis, paranoia, hallucinations. And that is in part what oftentimes makes that functional decline so precipitous, because people aren't able to often continue to work at the same level they were. And it becomes a very significant part of their life. And other things fall away.
Dr. Sylvia, I'm thinking about how television shows and movies often will portray people who are using meth, and it's people who are really skinny, really agitated, bad teeth. Is that accurate? And if so, why? Why is that?
I think, you know, there's sensationalizing of drug use in the media, and so I think we have to be careful about that and make sure, you know, we're thinking about each individual in front of us and what's going on for them. But it can cause some of those symptoms that you're talking about. So all stimulants will decrease your appetite. And if you're using stimulants every day, people just don't eat like they were before. And so they will lose weight. They can have tooth decay. Stimulants, in particular methamphetamine, will cause constriction of the blood vessels in the mouth, and that will reduce the blood flow to the teeth and cause mouth decay, tooth decay. So yes, that certainly happens. People can have what are called like paranoid hallucinations, where they will feel like there are bugs crawling on them or something going on with their skin, where they might start to pick at their skin to try to get that itchy sensation to go away. So people can have skin findings as well.
How challenging is it for you and other physicians to treat people who use meth and overdose from it?
I think it is challenging to treat methamphetamine, but it's not impossible. So there are no FDA-approved medications for methamphetamine use disorder the way they are for opioid use disorder. We have, you know, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. Those are excellent medications, and people do quite well with medications for opioid use disorder. The medications for methamphetamine use disorder have been studied. They've been studying them for years. They're a few medications out there that we try, but they don't have the same success rates as what you'd have with, say, a buprenorphine or methadone. Really, the best treatment out there is a behavioral therapy. It's got a funny name. It's called contingency management. It's actually a technique that uses positive reinforcement, which we provide in the form of a reward or incentive, and that encourages a desired behavior and discourages an undesired behavior. Hmm. It's actually based on the principle of operant conditioning, where actions are shaped by the consequence. So in substance use treatment, we can provide a reward to a patient for, say, coming into the office and providing a urine that's negative for stimulants, or perhaps like coming to an appointment or something like that. And when people get rewarded, they get a little spike of dopamine, and it's a way to try to, I tell patients, it's like trying to rewire your brain to get excited about something that's not methamphetamine. And, you know, we are piloting that along with some other programs in the state and seeing really good results with contingency management. So we're hopeful that that may be one of many, many possible treatments in the future.
Dr. Sylvia, before we say goodbye, I just wanted to ask if there's anything you would like people in the general public, our listeners, to understand about methamphetamine that you haven't said so far.
I think I would add that, you know, folks who have substance use disorders are the same as people who don't have substance use disorders, right? This is just one of many chronic medical conditions that people can have. This one is front and center, right? People have are, you know, outside sometimes, living on the street. You might drive by them in your car. And I think it's very easy for the public to think that this is somehow a choice on people's parts, and that, and but what I see is a lot of stigma and a lot of judging that happens. And when people finally have the courage to come in and seek treatment, they carry a lot of that stigma with them. And I think the more that we can support people and encourage them to get help and be understanding, the better we're all going to be.
Dr. Silva, thank you. That was Dr. Kristen Silva, who is Chief Division Chief for Addiction Medicine at Maine Medical Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about methamphetamine use and why it's becoming more prevalent in Maine, also how it affects those who use it and some avenues for them to get help. My guest today, Matt Emke, who has been in recovery for many years and now facilitates groups for others in recovery. Gordon Smith is Director of Opioid Response for the State Office of Policy, Innovation, and the Future. And Leslie Clark is Executive Director of the Portland Recovery Community Center. We invite you to join the conversation. What are your questions? Are you concerned about someone you know? Send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Stephanie Pelkey, who is in recovery at Macaulay Residence in Portland after years of dealing with substance use. Thank you so much for calling in, Stephanie.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
As you know, we're talking about methamphetamine today, and I'm wondering if you would mind letting us know how you came to be a user of that.
Okay. I grew up in a family that I always used alcohol. I was given alcohol by the time I was 3 years old. And then it developed into using other drugs during my teenage years. So after I, let me think about how old I was. So I was, I think, 27 when I first got my kids taken from me. Uh-huh. And at this time, I didn't know that substances were a problem for me. I just thought that it was a solution, because before I found the solution, drugs were my solution. So I did quit at that time. I got my kids back. I thought that that was everything that I would need to move on and have a normal life. But when I got them back, I didn't get better. So now that the eyes of authority were off me, I reverted to the ways that I had when I was a teenager. So like, as long as nobody saw what I was doing, I was fine. So I got worse. I started using drugs IV. And then shortly after came the meth.
I don't know if you heard earlier Matt talking about what meth did to him. Was it for you as well the worst of the worst?
It was the worst of the worst, but the unfortunate thing is that the first time that I tried it, I thought that it was my solution to life. I thought that I was missing out this whole time. I want to say I was about 30 years old before I found it, but I felt like it was the key to enjoying life like everybody else did normally, because I do have ADHD, and it went untreated my whole life. So there was a short period before the psychosis set in where I convinced myself in my delusion, my addiction, convinced myself that this was helping me. It was stimulating my brain. So yeah, I thought it was the solution.
Where are you, Stephanie, in your recovery? How long have you been not a user?
So I got clean this time on September 21st, 2022. And so I'm about 2.5 years.
What advice would you give someone else? What advice would you give them about recovery and sticking with it?
So for me, what worked the best is the community. When I came in this time, I was broken, but I wasn't hopeless. I didn't know what hope looked like. So I found myself at the PRCC, the Portland Recovery Community Center, looking for the safety that I knew was in recovery, but I didn't want to be clean. So for a while, I just leaned on the community, and it was the people around me at the PRCC that directed me to sober living. I got into sober living, and then I was seeing the women hold each other up. I was seeing them come in every day smiling, and they said that they once came from the same hell that I came from. So it was curious to me, but that's why I stayed. So community, is definitely one of the biggest things. I've also learned while being at Macaulay to ask for help, which was very uncomfortable at first. And I've learned to be vulnerable, because when I share my experience, strength, and hope, and trust my feelings with another person, it helps to take them out of the black hole of their own addiction. Another thing that's helped is meetings. Also, I do the 12 steps, so I practice the AA 12 steps, that's what we adapt at the Crystal Meth Anonymous meeting anyway. It's basically the same words, only we interject crystal meth instead of alcohol. And working with another addict has definitely been the key to me.
That's wonderful advice. I understand you're studying automotive technology. What a great field to go into.
I am. I'm so excited. I actually have an application that I just picked up today to work at Prompto, and I've never been this excited in my life. So,
oh, well, good luck with that. Congratulations. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Stephanie Belke is about to graduate, as she just mentioned, from the 2-year recovery program at Macaulay Residence. Oh, wow, that too. So fantastic. two degrees in one fell swoop. Thank you, Stephanie. Let's see. We'll go quickly to Sean in Auburn. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer, and thank you for taking my call. First of all, congratulations to the previous caller. That's a great program at Macaulay House. And I, too, worked the steps and have just celebrated 10 years of continuous sobriety.
Wow.
However, my biggest concern, having been in this recovery community for the last 10 years, is, you know, how treatment and the politics of paying for treatment lines up with success. I love sober living. I love the peer-to-peer aspect. And maybe Gordon can recognize my voice, but I've been involved heavily in both things. And unfortunately, so I was involved with Courage House in Gorham, and we did a great peer-to-peer recovery residence, but it was not sustainable without main care money, and has turned over to treatment. And I think that the AA process and peer-to-peer support is really the key. And other than medication and what we call MAT, the treatment side doesn't seem to be working in my eyes, and I'd like you all to comment on that. Thank
all right,
you.
Sean,
I wish there was MAT. One last comment. I wish there was MAT for methamphetamine.
Yeah, I have a feeling you're not the only one. I'm going to turn to Gordon first and then Leslie. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, thank you, Sean. I do recognize your voice, of course. And congratulations to all three of you who are in recovery and who have the courage to tell your stories, because it really helps other people. Treatment does work, Sean. I don't think you really meant necessarily to say that it doesn't. everybody's journey is different and everybody's substances are different. And so we have more effective treatment in some for some things than others. I mean, thank goodness we have methadone and Suboxone now, and now many people are doing well with Sublocade, the injectable version of Suboxone. We don't have, as Kristen Sylvia said, as Dr. Sylvia said, we don't have a lot of treatment of particularly medications for stimulants and meth specifically. But that's why contingency management is something to look at, and why we have in our strategic plan, as you'll recall, Sean, to have a pilot, to pilot contingency management. And we have that in place right now in the Bath, Brunswick, Portland, and Norway, South Paris areas. So, you know, I'll finish up because we could spend the rest of the time on this. Of course, with the cuts to in the federal government, the cuts that Governor Mills was criticizing today to Medicaid potentially, which is so important to provide coverage for people, we're still going to have enormous challenges. Even if we didn't have those cuts and a flat state budget, it's always going to be difficult to have enough resources to pay for everybody's treatment. So it is an enormous challenge. But again, we have increased treatment, a tremendous amount of particularly outpatient treatment over the past 6.5 years. And that is no doubt one of the factors that's led to the 40% decline in mortality in our overdoses. So don't give up, Sean. You've experienced a lot of stuff. You've done a lot of positive things. And I don't want people to leave this call thinking there isn't treatment, because there is. And it takes, right, it takes an average, Jennifer, 6-7 times before it takes. But it takes 29 times for a person to try to quit smoking successfully. So why would we think that if it takes 29 times to quit smoking, that all of a sudden the person today that's been using drugs for 10 years is going to say, okay, here's my day, I'm going to stop today? This is complicated. And that's why I'm so grateful for Stephanie and Matt and Leslie to talk about their journeys, because it lets people know that we're just people. They're just people. And Kristen made a great note of that.
Leslie, is there anything you'd like to add to what Gordon has said?
I really appreciate all of these comments. And you know, treatment is really important. And it, you know, I always think about it being the trifecta of behavioral health and good medical treatment, not just for the addiction itself, but for, you know, our bodies as people in recovery, myself included. You know, it takes a big toll, any addiction, and having good health care, good mental health care. But I want to talk just a little bit, and I don't think I can say it any better than Stephanie did, about what it means to be in recovery and have recovery community, and why recovery community centers throughout the state are so important and free for everyone. So whether you, insurance, none of that matters. Everything that we do is free and mostly run by peers and volunteers. But it's important that people understand, in the message of hope, you know, you heard several people say, and I felt the same way, is that drugs or alcohol felt like our solution. This is like what makes it possible for me to get by and be in the world. And the idea of losing or even, you know, radically reducing a substance that you're dependent on in every way and believe it's helping you is really scary and not appealing. And what the message, I think, is that recovery is so much more than about getting into remission from SUD, from substance use disorder, or abstinence or reduction. Recovery, when we talk about recovery, it's more than the absence of symptomology. It is the presence of health. It's the presence of well-being. It's knowing that you have a positive identity, that we belong, that we're part of, like Matt said, we're like our doctor, somebody said, we're like everyone. I think Dr. Sylvia, we're all people and we belong And we have purpose. We can help the next person. And at the sort of level of meeting someone in their substance use, you know, the idea of giving up the substance, I think it's important, the message, and someone like with crystal meth, you know, the benefit of giving it up. You're going to be able to sleep. How many people on crystal meth have not slept for days and days and days? And the idea of being able to sleep is a positive. You're going to feel better. You're going to be happier that this is possible.
Thank you, Leslie. We do need to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today is substance use in Maine, especially the rise in meth use. What to know about prevention, treatment, and recovery. Joining me, Gordon Smith, who is Maine's Director of Opioid Response, Leslie Clark with Portland Recovery Community Center, and Matt Emke, who has been in recovery for several years and is a peer leader in the recovery community. Matt, before we move on, I just wanted to talk to you about the calls we've just had. We've just heard from two others who are also in recovery or hoping to be in recovery, but whose stories are very different than yours. And before we move on, I wanted to know, as you reflect on their what you've heard today from them, what you think the rest of us should know.
And I think this was brought up before. You know, stigma is a huge part of is a huge barrier in addiction and recovery. Not only is it, you know, people who are not addicts or alcoholics, you know, stigmatizing the addicts, the alcoholics, but even within the recovery community, there's this purity test as far as that some areas of AA and other 12-step groups will judge people who are taking, you know, medication-assisted treatment, who are taking Suboxone or something else. And it's the stigma is something that can keep addicts and alcoholics from finding treatment or even acknowledging it in themselves. And I just want to say to anyone who is, you know, used in the process of trying to get sober, or wants to get sober, or wants to want to get sober, there is hope. There really is hope. You know, I started this group, Carry the Message, back in 2019. It's the only Crystal Meth Anonymous group in the state of Maine. And it has grown beyond belief. We even have our own softball team, the Crystal Ballers. but, you know, we do a lot of commitments. And I will say, like, you know, it's fun. You know, it is, you can have fun that you had never imagined you could have before, without a 20 time, you know, increase in your dopamine levels. And you're going to remember it the next day, and you're going to have self-esteem because, you know, you're doing these esteemable acts, helping others. And that's a whole different kind of fun. It's sustainable. And I just want to offer everyone who may be struggling out there with the idea that there is hope. You know, many of us have done it. So,
calling in now is Amber Saunders. She lives in Caribou, where she was born and raised, and she's in recovery at the Crossroads Program for Women and Children, and also volunteers at the Recovery Center. I'm trying to read fast. Sorry, Amber, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I think a lot of people think of meth and they think of this as like a big city kind of thing, but obviously you're calling from Caribou. How did you come to be involved with in using meth?
Honestly, like somebody showed up at my apartment one time and was like, hey, you want to try this? And I did, and I got hooked on it, and I was on it for about 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I lost my oldest son. I gave up custody of him to his father. Like, we have shared custody, but, like, I don't see him or anything because, like, you know, like, I chose drugs, you know, over my kids. I used, when I was pregnant with my middle child, I had him all the way up until, you know, the state took him when I got incarcerated because I was using. And I did 6 months in jail. I got out and I instantly started back up again because I thought there was no hope, you know. I just kept using and using. And then I got pregnant with my daughter back, like, well, she's a little over a year now, year old. And I used my whole pregnancy. The state came in to the hospital room because I was all by myself because her father was incarcerated. I had to do it all on my own. And my doctor came in and was like, you know, you have an option. You can either, you know, you can go to rehab and get clean, or, you know, you can try doing it on your own. She's like, but, you know, that little girl needs you. And literally, my daughter was born March 22nd of last year, and I went to rehab on my own April 15th of last year, and I've been clean ever since.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, and I came back up to my hometown, and that's where I live, where I was in active use.
How do you stay with it?
I go to meetings all the time. My home group up here is the Most Powerful Vehicle Group. It's a phenomenal group, and like, I absolutely love it. I go every Saturday, and we just started a new one a couple months ago on Tuesday. So like, I make sure I go every Tuesday and every Saturday. My daughter, I finally got full custody of my daughter. That happened. My sobriety, like my clean date is April 15th. So I celebrated my 1 year then, and they granted me full custody of my daughter April 17th. So it was a good month in April.
It sounds like it was a wonderful month. Leslie, I know you had a thought that you wanted to join. I'm going to, Amber, for a second, turn to Leslie Clark. Go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah, we were talking about stigma and the barrier that stigma creates for people seeking help. And I think some of that is internalized as well, and especially for moms. And I just really loved hearing this story of the perseverance, Amber, that you have and have had, and knowing that, and maybe hearing a little bit more from you about what that's like, the stigma that especially goes for moms when we are struggling with substances.
Yeah, it was very tough. Like, you know, like, oh my God,
I hear your daughter.
it was just, you know, it was hard. Like when I went to camp, like the first 2 weeks I was there, I wouldn't leave my room. It took like literally like my caseworker to bring my daughter down to see me, and then like something like just snapped in me, and like I did 360, and like, you know, like I completed it, and I came up to a sober living house and in Caribou, and it was just it was a struggle. I mean, it still is a struggle, but like, you know, I just think about everything that I have accomplished and what I can accomplish.
Well, I'm so impressed, and it's not easy being the mother of a very young baby, a toddler as well. So you're really doing it, raising what sounds like a very active young girl. And I wanted to know how you are helping others, and what's your role today?
Well, like I said, like, you know, like I go downstairs because I literally live upstairs from the recovery center in my apartment. And like I go downstairs and like, you know, like sometimes like I'll hear like, you know, these girls come in here there and like talk about, you know, wanting to get clean and stuff. And I tell them, I'm like, look, you know, I know how you feel. I was like, you know, like I've been through it. I was like, honestly, like if I can do it, you can do it. I was like, you know, I have faith. I was like, and, you know, I tell them, I'm like, I live right upstairs. If anybody ever needs anything, I was like, you know, you just come right to the recovery center and I'll come down and I'll talk to you.
Well, Amber, I'm so happy to hear your story, to end our program on this story. And I think that's probably what you would say to anybody listening, is that there is hope, correct?
And a support, yes. And a support system is very, very, you know, good to have. Mine is my mom. Like if it wasn't for my mom bringing me to my meetings and dropping me off and doing everything, I don't think that, you know, it would have been possible.
Mm. Amber, thank you so much. Amber Saunders with the Crossroads Recovery Program in Caribou, and she helps other people in recovery. We really are almost out of time, but Leslie, I'm thinking if someone's listening to this and they're not somebody with a problem but knows somebody who is struggling, it sounds like the best thing you can do is to maybe be that ride or be that support.
Absolutely. The support and the love that people bring and acceptance and understanding, even though I know it can be so frustrating for a family member and so painful, but being that support person. And I'll just put in a plug for through the Department of Human Services, there are recovery community centers, 21 centers all over the state. Everything is free, and that includes family members' support for them.
Great.
So thank you.
That's Leslie Clark, Executive Director of the Portland Recovery Community Center. Matt Emke, a recovering addict and alcoholic who leads recovery groups. And, of course, with us, Gordon Smith, who directs the Governor's Office of Opioid Response. Main Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today, Jane Donahue was on the board. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.